This week I went for a Bible study with a friend of mine who's a very, very recent convert to Christianity, and he's not a Seventh-day Adventist, and so we were just speaking about a few things, and I was doing a Bible study on the Trinity. And as we were talking about the Trinity and kind of the concept of God and the nature of God and the character of God, as we were talking about these things, I could see his eyes widening. Have you ever had a Bible study like that where you're speaking to somebody and you can see the gears in their heads churning and then suddenly they get it? And he literally stopped in the study and he said to me, "Man, this is rocking my world." And he said to me, "Hey, can we in a few weeks go over this study again? Because it's so beautiful, I want to hear it again." And as I was going through, I thought, man, we are so blessed to have some of these realities and these truths of Scripture that sometimes I think we forget the beauty that we have. We sometimes forget the fundamental things about Christianity, and so we want to delve into other stuff, which is good and that is grand, but sometimes I think it's so good just to go back to the fundamental basic things because there's so much beauty, and that's what I want to do today. I want to speak about something that we all know and enjoy, and that's the reason why we're here. It's about the Sabbath. I want to speak about the Sabbath and what the Sabbath can mean to us, and I want to speak it in the context of this idea of rest. Thank you, Mel. Rest in an age of restlessness, a cycle of hope versus a cycle of despair. And I want to speak about this because I think there's a few of us that might be going through moments at this present time where we feel a bit stretched. There's a cycle where we're feeling a bit taxed. We're feeling that things are a bit difficult at the moment. I've had a few conversations this week where a few individuals have said to me, "Man, things are a bit tight at the moment. Things are a bit, you know, I feel a bit stretched. I feel a bit thin." And one of those conversations was this morning with one of my friends. This is his boy, Reuben. And Reuben is 5 years old at the moment. And he's at the beach having a great time. But the thing is that Reuben has had a very difficult life. Reuben was born 11th of April, 2014. And 4 months after he was born, he was diagnosed with cancer in the eye. And since then, he's always struggled with this. And this is Reuben and his dad, Hendrik de Vinar. And they're at hospital actually waiting for the doctors to tell them, is the cancer there, is the cancer not there? And they've been through these processes over and over, these cycles of despair, where they go to hospital and there's been times where it's been in remission, where he's been cleared, and then it just comes back. And quite recently, it's just come back again. And I was speaking to him about that. And here we have pictures of him just at the hospital and there he's getting a scan. A little boy, he's always known hospitals. He's so used to going to doctors, to nurses. They know him on a first name basis. At the age of 5, he's had 10 chemotherapy sessions. That's intense. For a 5-year-old, think about the cycle of his life. 10 chemotherapy sessions, 45 laser therapy treatments, 30 chirotherapy treatments. A boy of 5 years old, his cycle is in and out of hospital. 2 radioactive plaque implants, 22 chemotherapy injections into both of his eyes, 50 blood tests, 2 CT scans, and they've just been, this year again, have been in and out of hospital. And as I was thinking about it, as I was speaking about it, I can remember the first moment when I heard that he had cancer was that my friend Hendrik had kind of given up his business and felt God was calling him to ministry. So he said, "I'm going to give up everything and I'm going to go to ministry." And then I can remember that he had just gotten to the university, just gotten to the Adventist University in Cape Town. And I just by happenstance, had been in the surroundings. And I thought, "Oh, let me go and see how he is." And I just heard that week and I went to go speak to him. And I said, "Man, this is a difficult period for you. You're in your first year trying to get through, you know, ministry, getting through life to serve God in everything that you have. And now suddenly this big bomb drops." And I could remember speaking to him there, standing there on the grass, looking at the beautiful Helderberg Mountain, thinking about all of these things. And he's like, "No, I know that God would see me through this." And 5 years later, his faith is still unshaken. He has these cycles of despair, the cycles of feeling stretched. But yet there is another cycle that speaks to him, a cycle of hope. And I believe a large part of all the conversations that we've had, a large part of that is a cycle of the Sabbath. And here's another picture of him going to the hospital, a relatively new one. But that is the picture that I imagine of this little kid and his family. Always a picture of hope And some of us might wonder, how do we get this picture of hope versus a picture of despair? Some of us might feel stretched at this moment, but we haven't had it for so long. Or maybe we have. Maybe week in and week out, month in, month out, year in and year out, there's something that keeps on stretching us. And we feel stretched so thin that it feels that there's a moment that we might just snap. That it feels like we just can't go on anymore. And that's why the beauty of the Sabbath is there. So I don't have the text on the screen, so I'm going to ask you to turn to your Bible. There's a few texts about the Sabbath that gives me tremendous hope. And as I was speaking to these individuals this week, as I was just chatting to my friend, I was constantly reminded of the beauty of the Sabbath and what it means to me. If I'm in a difficult situation, when I'm going through a period where I feel stretched, this is generally where I go to. And I want to go to Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8. And as you turn there, I want to ask you a question. The Ten Commandments was written on a specific thing. Can anybody tell me what it was written on? It was written on stone, right? It's written on stone. Actually, a stone of sapphire, right? A very strong. And can you imagine why that was written on stone and the rest of the covenant is written on paper or papyrus or whatever they had at that point, right? The one is representing something that cannot be changed. So just imagine in your mind that God comes to you and he gives you the Ten Commandments, which is basically his covenant, his constitution of his kingdom, the manifestation of his character in one sense. God is giving this to you to say, this is unchangeable, this cannot be changed, right? Keep that in your mind as we read Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20 is giving the commandments. And God spoke, and he's giving the Ten Commandments to them because they're already redeemed people. There are people that have been in slavery for 400 years and they have not known their God. But he has now liberated them and he gives them this declaration or this document of covenant. And it says, remember the Sabbath day. That's how it starts, which is very odd. They've had to ask you, why do you think God starts the commandment with remember? Some of us might say, well, because they were going to forget. Well, not really, because they didn't know about the Sabbath when they were in Egypt, right? And there's a lot of the other stuff that they would have forgotten as well, like worshiping other gods, not obeying their parents, maybe not stealing, not lying. Like, all of these commandments are important. The reason why God says remember, he's not saying remember because you're going to forget the commandment. I think the reason that he's saying remember is saying remember what the Sabbath is about. And you'll see how that comes out when we go to our next verse. But it says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So it says then, remember what it is about. And then he gives specific instructions that lead to some existential meaning within us. It says, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, which speaks of a purpose that God has for each of us. Within the Ten Commandments, within the Sabbath commandment, there's this idea that you were created for purpose. You were created to work and do something with your life. But on the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. That speaks to this idea of identity. There is a God that created us. So we have an identity. We find ourselves when we find him and find ourselves in him. It speaks about identity there. And it says, on it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or the livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. This gives this idea of liberation and equality. This idea that there are 6 days that you should labor and there might be slaves, but on the Sabbath day, everybody is equal. Everybody stands on the same plane. Nobody is higher than the other. It doesn't matter what's in your bank account or what's not in your bank account. It doesn't matter what car you came in or what you didn't come in. The fact of the matter is on the Sabbath day, we are all equal as people that bear the image of God. And then he swings back to this first word that he started. So you can imagine that the Sabbath commandment has a bookend to it. Remember, and then he says, he speaks about the purpose and identity. And then he swings back to the reason why we should remember. He says, remember the Sabbath day, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea that is all that is in them. And rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. The reason he says, remember the Sabbath day because it is a sign and it is a symbol of creation. It is what we would call a protological sign, a sign of the first things. So as the Sabbath swings around every week, we are to remember that we are created beings, that we should remember the creative narrative and what comes out of that. I want to give you a few ideas of what comes out of the creative narrative in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. We have spoken about some of these things, but it bears repeating. In the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 account, we get two different pictures of this creator God. In Genesis 1, the word there that is constantly used is the word Elohim, which is this idea that God is a powerful divine being. He says, "Let there be," and it stands fast. He creates universes by just speaking it. And in the story, we have this rhythmic structure of creation. It says, and God said, and then there's a command, let there be. Then there's a report, and it was so. There's an evaluation, and it was good. And then there's a time frame. And so as you're reading through Genesis 1, you kind of get into this rhythm of reading. As you're reading it, you kind of anticipate. You know what's coming on day 2. You know what's coming on day 3, because this rhythm bears repeating. If you think about it, God is so powerful that he could have said one word and everything would have been there in a millisecond. That's how powerful he is. He didn't need to take 6 days to create everything. I mean, how long does it take God to say, let there be light, and there's light? So what did he do? So somehow the story tells us that God knows what he's doing. There's a system. He knows what he's doing. And this rhythmic structure in the Hebrew scripture shows us that this God is thoughtful. What's interesting enough is that there's also this parallel that we have spoken before in this church, that there's this parallel between the 6 days, a horizontal parallel, day 1 and day 2 and day 3. He forms everything and then he fills everything. So we see a bit of thoughtfulness behind the creation story. But then there's this beauty of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, where there's this vertical parallel, where things are without form and void, where there's chaos and God brings rest. So when we come to the Sabbath, when we feel that we are stretched, and these cycles of stretching go on every day and every week and every month and every year, we feel tired and we're like, well, is there any hope? Yes, there is hope. Every day when we look forward to the Sabbath, when the Sabbath comes, it's a sign of hope that we are worshiping a creator God that knows what he is doing in creation. That we are worshiping a creator God that knows that he can move things from disorder to order, from chaos to cosmos. That's the whole point of the story, is that he moves it. That's the Hebrew word, tohu vavahu, which is a word that they would use to say things are just messed up. Things are going awry. Things are just not the way that it's supposed to be. Things are like it's a bit stretched, but it moves to Shabbat every week. The profound thing about the Genesis story is that it also speaks to 7 existential questions. Now, not all of these questions are immediately answered, but there's a seedbed in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 that starts speaking about the existential meanings or the questions that we have. The first one, security. Whom can I trust? When you look at the story of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, you not only see this transcendent, powerful God, but Genesis 2 shifts the story where it's not just Elohim, but Yahweh Elohim. This idea that now you have this personal God. In Genesis 1, God says, let there be, and it stands fast. In Genesis 2, he goes and he forms Adam from the dust of the ground and breathes in the breath of life. We have this concept, this idea that God is so intimately involved. He's not this deistic God that steps away, this absentee landlord. No. He is a God that steps into his creation, and he's so close to his creation. He knows what Adam is thinking. He knows what Adam is feeling. He sees Adam's loneliness and creates him a counterpart. In one sense, the Genesis account says to us that weekly, as the cycle of the Sabbath rings around, God knows you and cares for you. He sees where you are stretched and he walks beside you. He provides for you. He sustains you. He is your security. Whom can I trust? This God that only does good. The cycle in all of these things, Genesis 1 moves to this idea that everything is good, good, good. And then he says, very good. 7 times he uses this word, that everything is good within creation. In Genesis 2, it moves from this idea from incompleteness to completeness. So the idea that we get is this God, he wants the good for us. He wants completeness for us. Can I trust a God like this? 100%. The next question, identity. Who am I? I am not just a person walking around, just atoms and molecules. No. I am a person that is created in the image of God. Genesis 1 verse 27 says so that God saw us and he said he wanted to create us in the image of God. And he created male and female in the image of God. You are here because God wanted you to be here. He created you. He gives you identity, belonging. Who does God want me? Yes, he wants you. Psalm 51 says that he knitted you together in the mother's womb. He saw you. He knew you. He wanted you to be here. Significance. Do I matter? Yes. All of us matters. That's the reason God created us. He has a purpose. The whole thing about the Genesis account is that there's a purpose. There's a telos to the story. God doesn't just do something because, oh, I didn't see that happening. God knows what he is doing. That's the whole point of this rhythmic structure, that we can see that there's something behind what God is doing. And so God has a point with your life. He has a point for why you are here. You could have been born any other time in history, but why you were born here in this period of Earth's history is because God had a vision for this. Purpose. Competence. What do I do well? If you think about the creative process and how people come together and how God creates you, you have a specific set of skills, a specific set of talents, a specific temperament and personality, and all of these things coming together. And God is the one that has gifted you these things. You don't necessarily say, well, this is a talent that I made by myself. No, no, no. All the talents that you have is a gift from God. The faculties that you have and the temperament that you have and the personality you have, a lot of those things you can't choose. It is given to you. And by who gave it to you? Is it not God? Is he not the one that gave it to you to give you some competence that say, I know that you are unique and you can do something, and then permanence, where am I ultimately going? That links onto the second verse, if I can go there, Deuteronomy chapter 5, if you have your Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5, the word Deuteronomy is actually a juxtaposition of two words. It's the word deuteros, meaning second, and nomos, meaning law. So the Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. If you remember the story of Israel, that they had been wandering in the desert for 40 years. And they were wandering because they weren't faithful. And God said that the first generation that had wandered must die off before the new generation can go in. And when this new generation comes, Moses has to give them the law again, a reiteration of the law. And so he gives it to them in Deuteronomy chapter 5, the Ten Commandments given again. Now, remember earlier I asked you, what was the Ten Commandments in Exodus written on? And we said it was written on stone, something that is unbreakable, unchangeable. I want you to observe something very interesting about Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 12, it says, observe the Sabbath day. Immediately the Ten Commandments is changed. There's a difference here. It's now not remember, but observe. This word observe is the idea of celebration, of being happy. A few weeks ago, we had our church camp, and I gave a Bible study on Luke 15, the great chapter about the parables of the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the two sons. And what was interesting about this, as we were deconstructing this narrative, what was interesting about this is that in each narrative, in the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son, in each of them, when the thing that was lost is found, they celebrated. When the thing that was lost was found, they celebrated. There was a celebration. People came together. It was a joyous occasion. That's exactly what is happening here. This word observe means let's have a party. The Sabbath shouldn't be a drab day. A day that we're like, oh, it's the Sabbath. Oh, no. The Sabbath is a day of celebration. And remember, just like in Exodus, there is a bookend. The first thing correlates with the last thing. So he says, observe the Sabbath day. And he goes down very similar things. You must keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. And then he goes on. And then in verse 15, he says, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. And the Lord your God brought you out from here with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So he says in Exodus chapter 20, he says, remember the Sabbath day. And this is what you should remember. Remember that you are a created beings and that there's a creator God. Remember the creative narrative and all the implications that are there. But then he says to them, you shouldn't just remember. There's another dimension to the Sabbath. Remember that you are a saved person. Not really created, but recreated. He brings this new dimension into them and says that you were created. And we know that your creation story was good and well, but the enemy had come and he had messed up this plan of God. And from the beginning, God had set out to save us. And if you think about the narrative of Jesus, think about what Jesus did, you would see that the Sabbath is central to his mission. There's a point in Jesus' ministry where he gets up and they read a scroll and they're like, oh, the liberation of the oppressed, the blind can see, the deaf can hear, the mute can speak. And Jesus says, it has been fulfilled in your hearing. The profound thing is that when you see Jesus moving, you see it does a lot of these things on the Sabbath. The Pharisees and the church people are aghast. And how can he do this on a Sabbath? And Jesus is like, what do you mean? This is what the Sabbath is about. I can imagine that Jesus waking up on a Sabbath, in his internal mind, he would say to himself, it's Sabbath day, which means liberation day. Let me go and do good. Let me go and help people, because that's what the Sabbath is. Even our salvation pivots on the Sabbath. If you think about Daniel chapter 9, where the biggest prophecy of the Messiah, the time prophecy of the Messiah that would come, is so specific. We know that all of this revolves around the Passover, all of these things. Jesus could have chosen to come at any point in earth history. He could have chosen to die on any points of earth history. Jesus wasn't killed by the Romans. He sacrificed himself. The beauty of this is that Jesus dies on the Friday before the Sabbath. He stays in the tomb on the Sabbath and resurrects on the Sunday. Sunday, which would be the first day of the week, the new day of creation. Jesus rests on the Sabbath because the Sabbath is a symbol of our salvation. Maybe you're feeling stretched because of something that you have done. Consequences of your sin. Consequences of somebody's sin. Consequences of certain things that you need liberation and salvation from. Not only is there a weekly reminder that you are loved, that there's purpose in your life, that God is there for you and sustaining you and helping you, but there's also a weekly cycle of the Sabbath reminding you that you are saved by the same God, that you are liberated, that there's nothing too heavy weighing on you that he cannot lift. You are not so in such a dark place that he cannot shine his light there. The Sabbath is a cycle that reminds us of these things. There are cycles where we are stretched and we can focus on those, or we can focus on the cycle of liberation and creation and recreation. So we have these cycles, the one focusing back, protological, first things. The other one is soteriological, salvation things. But there's another one, a last one, if you have your Bibles, Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews is a beautiful book, and this is actually one of the last very explicit sections where it speaks about the Sabbath. And the book of Hebrews is actually not a letter. It is a very beautifully crafted sermon. And we're not exactly sure who wrote the sermon. Some people think it's Paul. Others think it could be somebody else. It doesn't really matter who it is. It's a beautiful sermon about Jesus. About Jesus is greater than anything else. And the beautiful thing about the sermon in Hebrews is that he's trying to help these people that he's addressing with some issues that they are having. They're feeling stressed and they're wondering if they should keep on walking this faithful path. And so, in a sense, what he does is that he takes out the family album, the Hebrew family album, and he starts saying to them, let's look at history. And he starts recounting the meta-narrative of the Old Testament. And he recounts certain individuals and certain things. And he's saying, look at all of these people, how they've been faithful. Remember how all of these things happened. But all of them point to Jesus. Jesus stands head above shoulders above all of them. And he is the one that we're looking forward to. We are looking to him, and let's be faithful because he is faithful to us. Now, the beautiful thing is in Hebrews chapter 4, it picks up that Jesus is greater than Moses, and then it speaks about the rest of God's people that was promised. I'm going to pick up in chapter 4 and verse 4. He says, for he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way. So he's speaking about the Sabbath. And God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, in this passage, he said, they shall not enter into my rest. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter it because of disobedience. Again, he appoints a certain day, today, saying through David so long afterward in the words already quoted, today, if you hear my voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would have not spoken of another day later on. So then, therefore, remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his work as God did from his. Now, if you've ever read through Hebrews, you'll know that there are some points that is very confusing. This chapter is one of them, that if you don't have all your bearings in place, it can seem a bit confusing. But let me explain it to you. It's very easy. He uses the Sabbath as a vehicle to communicate a specific theological message. And there's three specific Sabbaths that he speaks about. The first one is the archetypal Sabbath, the Sabbath of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, the weekly Sabbath that we experience. And he says that weekly there is a Sabbath that we can rest. But there is another Sabbath that is very similar to that, which we would call the typical Sabbath. The typical Sabbath would be the new Canaan that the Israelites would have gone into. And he's speaking about that first generation that didn't go in there because of disobedience. And he's saying, similarly, there's something to us, a Sabbath, an antitypical Sabbath, which is the new promised land that we are looking forward to. What he's basically saying is that one day when we get to heaven, when the new heavens and the new earth come down, that will be like an eternal Sabbath for us. What he's pointing or hinting at is that weekly we are reminded of the beauty that is coming. Weekly we are reminded of eternity that is coming. Weekly we should order our lives so that the Sabbath is a little bit of heaven on earth. Weekly, our Sabbath should be so invigorating and so pleasurable and so full of fellowship with God and others that we are looking forward for the new heavens and the new earth. So the Sabbath, in the midst of our stretching on this earth, in the midst of all the stuff that is pulling us in all directions, these cycles that happen, and sometimes it might be a day or two, sometimes it might be a week, sometimes it might be a month, sometimes it's years that we are stretched and pulled and stretched and pulled. Weekly, there is a cycle of hope, the Sabbath. And as the Sabbath comes, as this day comes, we don't just come to church and then go home. It's a day for us to remember that we come from a specific place. We come from Genesis 1 and 2, where that God said, "You will be my people. I have created you. I have given you identity and purpose. I created everything good, but we know that something went bad," and that's why we get to the second point, that I am the God that restores and redeems and liberates. And so as we go through this, we remember creation, we remember salvation, but we always look forward to the new heavens and the new earth. We look forward to being with him for eternity. And so when this world seems dark and we don't know where to go, we know that we can look back to the beauty of creation, we can look at the present of our salvation, and we can look forward to creation that is coming. New creation restored without sin and selfishness. The Sabbath is that symbol that points us to the Creator God, the Redeemer God, and the soon coming King. Reminds me of a story. Do you guys have Uncle Arthur's stories here? Uncle Arthur's children's stories? I had a pastor in our conference when I was very young. His wife, I don't know, they were probably at least 150 years old. I don't know. They've always been there, and they were always old. I just remember them since I've been yay high, and I can remember they're probably still alive. And they always, he still preaches, she would tell children's stories. And I can remember, she told this story a million times probably. I don't know. I've heard that story. But it was one of my favorite stories. It's a story, and you might know it. If you've read Uncle Arthur, you'd know this is one of his good stories. The story of the boy that made the boat. Does anybody know the story? Where this boy, he loved playing with the boats on the river. And so he would go and he built this boat by himself. Crafted it. Took hours to build this beautiful boat. And when it was finally done, he put his name, his initials under the boat. Said, "This is my boat. I made it with my own hands." So he went down to the river. There was a lot of rain that day. And he said, "I'm going to go down. The river's going to be pumping. I'm going to go." And he put his boat in, but the river was too strong and it took it off. A few days later, he's walking around in town and he goes to the pawn shop and he sees there that somebody had picked up his boat and now sold it to this guy. So he walks into the shop and says, "Sir, that is my boat." So it's not your boat. It's my boat. Says, no, give it to me. Guy gets the boat. He says, "Turns around. You see those letters? See those initials? My boat. I made this with these two hands." Guy says, "Sorry, boy. I bought this boat. It's my boat. So if you want it, what do you need to do?" "To buy it back." So he went back home and he just did every chore that he could. He was trying to get money, saved as much as he can. And one day walked into this place, put his money down and said, "Please give me my boat." Got the boat, and as he walked out, he says, "Now you're mine twice over. First I made you, and now I bought you." Isn't that the redemption story? Now, I would like to change the story. It's not a perfect change, but I would imagine that he would go into the store, and he would say, I want to buy this boat. And he would put all his money down, and he'd say, "But wait a second, I don't want to take the boat yet. I first need to go back to the river because there was so much water that it damaged the river. I want to make sure that it doesn't get lost again. So I want to go back to the river and fix everything, and then I'll come back, and I'll get my boat." Because that's what Jesus did. He created us, he saved us, he paid everything, and now he's still fixing the problem. He's fixing the problem in us, and he's fixing the problem in the universe. But he is coming again to redeem us and to restore us. And weekly, when we are depressed and we're feeling stressed and we're feeling like this is just too difficult, weekly we are reminded of these beautiful realities that we are created with a purpose, that we are loved beyond anything else, and God is restoring the universe so that we don't have to go through this ever again. Isn't that the beauty of the Sabbath? The Sabbath isn't something that we keep. The Sabbath is something that keeps us. It keeps us from being able to survive in a world that is just about chaos. The Sabbath is something that keeps us, that when we're feeling stretched thin, it gives us hope to keep going. And so as we go into this week, as we go into a new week, you might be feeling stretched at this moment. There might be stuff that's going wrong in your life in some way. This might not take or alleviate the stretchiness of your life, but it will give you hope to cope with the stretchiness, because it tells you that you're not alone. It tells you that you don't have to navigate all this by yourself. You have a creator God that created out of nothing. And if you have nothing to give, if you have nothing inside of you anymore, that's when God can do his best work.